The view from my office yesterday. Someone else showed a view from their office, and I was pretty sure that boat was full of cotton headed out, so I had to take a picture of it going down the river. But when I say, are our textbooks correct, I really mean the conventional wisdom that we all teach our students and we all rely on. And you get to the cutting edge and you go, boy, you know, we're really not so sure that these seemingly factual statements are really correct. And one of the key things I want to talk about is water stress and ethylene in cotton. So you have to wonder why a guy, I'm from Utah State University, why a guy from Utah is out here talking about cotton. Well, this is our research facility, which is where all of the work was done. Utah's in the middle of the mountains. The valley's 5,000 feet, the mountains are 10,000 feet, and this is the one view you can take that doesn't show mountains. They go up big on both sides, but it allows me to get up and take a picture down. So if you look at this picture, and real close inside this, and then we blow that up real big, there's their cotton. And I want to tell you, we're the biggest cotton producer in the state of Utah, right here in these research greenhouses. And I did some math because I was hearing about Texas. What's Texas? 5-6 million acres, and Georgia's, what's Georgia? 2-3 million acres. And so I did some calculations for cotton production in Utah. The 2,000 acreage was 0.02 acres. But there's one statistic in which we really stand out. We have the highest input, the cost inputs per acre of any state in the nation for this cotton. So it's a small amount of cotton, intensively studied, and it's all in greenhouses and grow chambers. We just turn the dials. We want to get Texas conditions, we got Texas, Georgia, Louisiana, everywhere. Other people use these same techniques, and in fact, my whole career is in controlled environments, and I always have felt they're critical intermediate when we scale from molecular people up to the field. Each level, we're closer to the field, and yet we have considerable control over the plants. Now, there's a lot of people that say, well, yeah, you've shown that in a growth chamber, but I don't believe that'll happen in the field. If that's the case, we need to make them happen. If a plant responds in a growth chamber in one way and it responds in another way in the field, we've got a problem. We don't understand the system. And yesterday we all saw examples of yields that went one direction in some years and another direction in another year, interactions. That's just a sign we don't fully understand the plant response to environment yet. We ought to be able to do that in a controlled environment exactly the same way, year after year after year. And if we can't, we really don't understand it. So a couple of comments, general comments, since I'm the first speaker on stress physiology. I'm going to call this axiom number one. Some stress is good. We spend so much time trying to get rid of all the stress. And you think about that, some stress is good in people too. What is it, Socrates that said the unexamined life is not worth living? Well, I think we could say the unstressed life is not worth living either. Stress makes us really productive, and it just can't be too much stress and too severe. And that's the key, is relating it. But we all know that stress makes plants more rigorous, makes them tougher, able to withstand future stresses. The key is the amount of stress and when it happens. So I might add to this, axiom number two. If I had a number one, I gotta have a number two, right? The effects of stress are hard to predict in both plants and people. We can model optimally grown plants very accurately and predict yield. If there's no water stress, no nitrogen stress, no temperature stress, we can tell you what the yield is. Now you start putting stress in there and erratic things happen. And in fact, they happen in people too. But the key is to keep studying them and understand what's going to happen. Okay, so this is a little dichotomy that I've wondered about for years, and this is a bit of textbook wisdom. Plants with C3 photosynthesis are suited to cool temperatures. Plants with C4 photosynthesis are suited to warmer temperatures. Now, all students learn C3 and C4 in photosynthesis and introduction to plant physiology. And as a review, if you're not familiar with these, how many plants with C4 photosynthesis do we have? Crop plants. Not weeds, not other, but of the major crop plants, how many have C4? Corn, everybody gets that right away. Sugar cane. Sorghum. Now name one more. It gets thin.
Amaranth.
Yeah. No, amaranth is, well, okay. Seed amaranth. The fourth one I usually say is millet. And after that, it's grass is used for forage. And we have something like well over 1,000 crops that are C3 crops. C4 is unusual in crop plants, but the crops that are C4 are big. But, so here's what we teach our students year after year, but then I put a little caveat on there, except cotton. Cotton loves it warm. It has C3 photosynthesis. It violates all the rules for photosynthetic pathways. It should have massive photorespiration in the warm temperatures that it grows, and it likely does, but as you all are well aware, it needs warm temperatures. So what's going on with cotton? It's clearly C3 photosynthesis. Why does it like it so warm? Here's part of the reason. This is some cotton data in the field, and there's the air temperature and there's the canopy temperature. The difference between these two, this is a day and a night on this thing, the difference between those two lines is 11 degrees Celsius, about 20 degrees Fahrenheit. That is an enormous difference. As a person that's worked mostly on other crops, when we get to be 3 and 4 degrees cooler than the air, I'm thinking, boy, those stomates are really smoking. And here comes cotton. 11 degrees. The stomate's got to be the size of footballs in cotton. It's just fluxing the water through itself. And yeah, where's the temperature stress? The plants were only at 30 C and the air temperature was well over 100 Fahrenheit. So that's part of the key for cotton, is just evaporative cooling so it doesn't get hot. And this graph, by the way, I want to point out that try to stay current. This is from Burke and Wanjura, 2010 publication, chapter 12. Now I want to show you this fine book that this came out of. You open the first page and it says 2010 is the copyright. And I had an opportunity yesterday afternoon and yesterday evening to look through this. And I have to say to all the editors, I've met Jack and Derek and James. I'm impressed. This is a good book. I know it took a long, long time to come out, but the product is worth it. And boy, if this really sells for $50, you ought to buy 10 copies each, because I like it. Put it up here in advertising. Now, my talk is about, are our textbooks correct? So let's take a look at this book. Here it is. So I want to talk a little about hormones now, because that's been a focus of much of my work on cotton. And we all teach about hormones in introductory plant physiology. So what is a hormone? Well, it's a molecule that signals things in extremely low concentrations. I'm going to talk about how low, but the analogy that comes to mind with hormones is one of our university marching bands out on the field with no drum major. They're going randomly all over the place. Now we get one single drum major, and 300 people in the band and they're all organized and they go in the right direction. That's a hormone. That one signal molecule is telling all the carbon in the plant where to go, what to do. It's like a light switch that's controlling big power in the plants. Because these are such low concentrations, we use them all the time to manipulate plants, because trace amounts, we can get the plant to do all kinds of things. I like to compare plant physiology to people, just as my stress example a minute ago. And in animals, a hormone has to be produced in one place and transported to another place to qualify as a hormone. Now, we don't use that strict a definition in plants. But now we start to make the comparison, and most of us know the hormones in plants, but we probably know more about hormones in plants than in our own bodies. How many hormones are there in humans? Anybody know? There's over 30 identified hormones in humans. And for all those 30 hormones, there's pharmaceuticals to make them go up and down, and it's big money. So we use the same thing in plants. Here's the classic five hormones in plants that every student answers on a final exam of plant physiology, and roughly the year that they came along. Since about 1970, the quest has been on to find other hormones, and now here's six more compounds that are active and qualify as hormones in plants. Now, the only one of these I'm going to talk about is ethylene, because I think that's one of the most poorly understood hormones, but these are all signaling things in plants. So I guess in plants we're up to 11, the five classic hormones and six here, we're up to 11 hormones. So chapter 26 now in our new textbook. This is beautiful. The structure of the hormones. I took this picture last night in my hotel room, and you'll see auxins, gibberellins, cytokinins promote growth. Ethylene, abscisic acid, inhibit growth. Now, this is our conventional wisdom. The books all say this. I guess I highlighted that to show growth inhibitors. Well, let's take a look at ethylene. To what extent is this a growth inhibitor in the plant? And by the way, this is not some lightweights that made this table. The authors are two of the heavyweights in the field in this group. So, and it's a great chapter. This is some data from our colleague Ray Wheeler at NASA Kennedy. Now, NASA has big problems with ethylene on the space station, and I've worked with NASA my whole career. It's a trace pollutant, and it's very hard to scrub it out of the air. So it affects all the plants we've been growing in space for many years. Here's the life cycle of four crops. When does it peak? We tell our students ethylene's the ripening hormone. It peaks at the end of the life cycle. No, it doesn't. In wheat and soybeans, it triggers reproductive events and pollination. How can that be a stress hormone? It's telling the plant when to set seeds. If we completely block ethylene, we can make some of these plants sterile. So it's a key thing to trigger, particularly triggering pollination. We now know that ethylene is produced in every cell of the plant through its whole life cycle. It's continuously signaling things. And I'm going to show you how it varies through the day in plants. Some plants produce a lot more ethylene than others, but it's not just the ripening hormone. I said these hormones are produced effective at very low concentrations. Now let's look at how low, what the levels might be. I'm going to compare this to carbon monoxide. And everybody knows trace amounts of carbon monoxide are really a problem. It turns out you can start to detect, you get headaches at around 50 parts per million carbon monoxide. And higher than that, of course, it can cause death from bad burners. Well, 50 parts per million is 50,000 ppb, and plants begin to detect ethylene at 5 parts per billion. 5 parts per billion. A part per million would be one red marble in a cubic meter of white marbles. So this table might be 2 cubic meters. So if it's a box of white marbles, one's red, that's a part per billion. A part per million is one red marble in about 3 of these rooms. That's a trace gas. It's one red marble in the size of a house. So it's a very trace gas with big effects. Incidentally, in the field, levels of 5 to 10 parts per billion are common with air pollution. We've seen them even during our little 10-minute rush hour. We've seen ethylene get to 20 parts per billion near the research greenhouse. Fortunately, only last 10 minutes, but I know that cities like Houston have recorded 10 or 15 parts per billion for a whole day. So there's the potential for air pollution to cause problems with plants. So ethylene is 10,000 times more toxic to plants than carbon monoxide is to people. So trace amounts have a big effect. Okay, the textbooks all say ethylene, being a growth inhibitor, decreases cell enlargement and internode elongation. It shrinks plants. So let's look at that. Here's corn, up to 500 parts per billion, and we can shrink corn perfectly with ethylene. If you didn't have controls, you would think this plant over here on the right was perfectly healthy. And in fact, if we stop the ethylene, it just starts growing right away again the next day. So ethylene is shrinking every cell in that plant. Here's cotton, same thing. Little bit less sensitive than corn, but the leaves are smaller, the internodes are smaller. You look at this, you think there's a potential for putting ethylene on at the right levels as a growth regulator, but it's very tricky to get it exactly right. So both of these slides support the hypothesis that ethylene shrinks cells. Now let's put some ethylene on soybeans. These, by the way, were continuously gassed with ethylene. Wow, what's going on with soybeans? They're really confused. It shrinks the leaves, but the internodes got bigger. So this is an example of how poorly we understand ethylene. In some species, it's shrinking internodes. In other species, it's increasing internodes. And we now know that this is not specific to soybeans. There's many species that are in which internode elongation is promoted by ethylene. So I want to talk about a compound that we have been working on, and Derek and Tom Cawthorn have been working on it, that blocks the perception of ethylene in plants. It's called 1-MCP, and we're going to hear more about that, I think, in other talks. I like to think this is like an anti-inflammatory agent for plants. If plants overreact to stress, we want to block that overreaction to stress. What do we do when we get a headache? Well, the headache's no purpose. You take aspirin and make it go away. You sprain your ankle, it swells up. The swelling is of no purpose. We put ice on it, we take anti-inflammatories to make the swelling go away. That's an overreaction to stress that's bad. Do plants overreact to stress? Well, probably. Can we figure out when they overreact? Maybe, particularly with 1-MCP. If we can block ethylene, and if it's causing plants to overreact to stress, it's got great uses. So here's some data on water stress and heat stress and ethylene. The textbooks generally, especially water stress, they say when plants are water stressed, they produce more ethylene, it makes the leaves fall off, causes all these bad things to happen. Here's water stress. The dashed lines are with 1-MCP. Now, in our case, we continuously gas the plants with 1-MCP to make sure they're protected. No effect at all from blocking ethylene. So this suggests maybe ethylene doesn't have such a big role in water stress. And this is, by the way, cumulative leaf growth. So we're out there with the ruler and getting the leaf elongation on these plants. But this is a mild stress. What if we stress them some more? Here's big stress, gradual and intermittent stress. Still no effect. Now, the treated generally doesn't make the plants worse. That's experimental error. But the dashed and dotted lines are right on top of each other. We have not been able to find a case where one MCP helps protect the plants against water stress, suggesting ethylene in vegetative growth doesn't have as big a role in water stress as we might think. And that's contrary to what the textbooks say about ethylene. Heat stress. Easy to have heat stress. You got three chambers, you turn the dials, you make one chamber the control, two of them hotter. These are three chambers. We get full sunlight levels of light in these chambers, full of cotton. Here's 33, 37, 40. Don't look at the absolute numbers so much, but their stresses, as evidenced by the fact that leaf elongation was reduced and no effect of MCP on the plants. So these have been surprising results considering the paradigm that ethylene is mediating all these stresses. Now let's look at how much ethylene the plants produce. Surely we water stress them, they're going to produce a lot of ethylene. We've done a lot of studies with closed systems on the right, and I am now convinced that every one of those studies is an artifact. And the literature is 95% from closed systems with ethylene studies, and I have serious questions about a big part of our literature. With help from the university and AgriFresh, we get some support to build open systems, big chambers with air blowing through them, and then we can look at ethylene synthesis. This is a thermal desorption that allows us to get to parts per billion ethylene. So what do these plants do in here? Four species, one of which is cotton, 12 days, and they produce different amounts of ethylene. Corn hardly produces any. Tomatoes produce a lot. Now, these are reproductive tomatoes, and they're well known to produce a lot of ethylene. But cotton and soybeans are similar. So these lines bounce around, right? So this is just noise in our data bouncing around. Let's take a closer look at the period of that noise, especially for cotton. And so I'm here. Here's cotton plants, by the way, now in these chambers. And there's one of our drought-stressed plots on the left-hand side. If you get bright light, we can grow beautiful cotton in these things. You know, Bill, you asked me, but what's the yield of our cotton? And I don't know. We're still trying to get enough to make one T-shirt. So can't say about the yield just yet. Here's a close-up of that cycling. Look how much these plants cycle. They're down around 5 at night and 40 in the day. That's almost an order of magnitude more ethylene in the day than at night. And look, they peak every day at the end of the day. They're making ethylene. What are they signaling to themselves? I'm thinking maybe they want to be conservative, keep the leaves from overgrowing at the end of the day, and then the ethylene goes down at night. But more than that, what happens when we water stress them? Now, this is short-term water stress here. We've also done long-term stress. We stopped watering, and that's when the green line becomes blue. So a couple days later, stress is beginning to occur, and the textbooks say there's a flush of ethylene. We didn't see it. And in fact, the textbooks also say when you resume watering, you really get a flush of ethylene. When we resumed watering down there right above the 12, ethylene almost completely stopped. And this is three replicate chambers of plants and three replicate green lines. So it had the exact opposite effect of what our textbooks say is happening with ethylene. So this now, looking in the literature, we're not the first people to see this. This is probably the most elegant system to show this in, but we have to rethink the role of ethylene in water stress, and I think probably in heat stress too. This is back to our plants. This is cotton plants now on balances. So we measure these balances with a computer, and every couple minutes we can tell the transpiration rate. Here's transpiration up and down. The bottoms are night, tops are the day. We're interested if blocking ethylene caused any change in those football-sized stomates, and none. There was no effect of ethylene on transpiration, but this is an example of this data. This 6 grams per minute, that's per plant, in my units, 5 millimoles per second in physiology units, wow, that is smoking. I mean, we get up to 2 and 3 on other kinds of plants. They're really fluxing through the water. Look what happens when we stress them. The whole plant starts to pulse for stomates, opens them, and it's like overshoots, closes, opens, closes. Happens when it's well-watered, happens when it's drought stress. It starts at the end of the day. The other amazing thing about this is a bit of a bell-shaped curve. The green lines are when they got watered. There was no water stress in these. The plants open their stomates, they peak about noon, and then they start to close. Well, yeah, everybody knows that. The sun goes down in the field. This is in a controlled environment. The light was exactly constant. The temperature was constant. The humidity was constant. It's a square wave of environmental conditions, and the stomates still closed. Something is making those stomates close that we don't understand. And it happens in all the plants we've studied, but cotton is the most responsive plant to this effect. Those stomates are 50% closed by the end of the day, even in bright light and low humidity. Jet lag in cotton. I'm going to probably have to stop on this slide. Wow. Cotton has a tremendous memory for the light period, far more than any other plant we've studied. Let me just come down here and point to this.
You can use a mouse.
Here's day and night, right? The daytime and the nighttime, perfectly uniform, 8-hour day, long night. Right here, we changed it on the plant. We went to a 16-hour day and 8-hour night. Look what happened. The plant was ready for night. It closed the stomates, even though the lights are on full blast. So one day, though, it gets over the jet lag. It starts to recover. It opens its stomates. Now we're back to, it's over the jet lag 3 days later. Now we change it again and make a long dark period. So it doesn't close, it's still opening. It keeps its plants completely open in the dark, completely open on its dark. And then halfway through the night period, it realizes it's night and it closes on it. So, and then it figures it out again a day later, it's night and day. So, cotton has tremendous jet lag for the stomates. It's a fascinating thing. I better stop there, right?
Yeah, we've been out of time. So
yep. Okay.
I guess we have a minute or two for some questions. If someone has any questions, or
you're going to get behind.
Yeah, we're going to get. Unfortunately, we're going to get a little bit behind if we do that. But we can. Bruce will be around all morning, I'm sure, and during the break we can you can talk to him one-on-one if you'd like. So, but anyway.
Do you want to take a question?
Does anybody have a question? We do have time for one or two questions. Go ahead,
Phil.
When you're at the plot plant, what are your thoughts on ethylene in urban gardening and urban agriculture?
Because of air pollution? I think most of the time the air is clean enough, it's not a big deal. The time when the plants are exquisitely sensitive to 5 parts per billion is right around the time of flowering. So the rest of the 5 parts per billion doesn't affect vegetative growth. It's just pollination. It's an amazing thing. We get flowers in there. Right at the time of anthesis, there's a spike of ethylene, and then that has to blow away like within 12 hours or it inhibits pollen germination. So ethylene has something to do with anthesis, but hours later it inhibits pollen tube growth. So it's a switch that turns one thing on and then stops.
Okay. So at this point, you really don't know why that cotton shuts down or why it has a memory?
No.
If we can adjust that somehow or another, we can make it produce day and night.
Yeah, no. No, we don't know. I took that slide out showing lots of crops, but all crops show that. It's just cotton shows it at least twice as much as any other plant that we've studied. And it's so responsive because of all the water. It's just exquisitely responsive to environment, which I think what you're saying is because of that, we could manipulate it to our advantage.
Okay.
Thank you, Bruce, very much.
Thank you.